80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I am your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Thank you for joining us on episode 9. Now you may be thinking to yourself, hey, I just heard them last week. They released episode 8 with Paul Raffert Jr. and they're back already a week later. Well, if you did not get a chance to hear last week's episode with Paul Raffert Jr., we did have a few announcements out front of the episode and towards the end. And one of them was that we are going to be changing to a weekly podcast release, and we're also changing the dates of the release. So now, you will be receiving a new podcast every Sunday. Subscribers get it a Saturday evening, and every Sunday it goes worldwide. So we are happy to be bringing that to you, starting with this week's episode, episode 9. Now, we're going to get right into this week's episode in just a few moments. I wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of things that have been going on in the Chasing Earhart universe with the last week's episode. We want to thank everybody for listening and downloading to last week's episode. It's our largest download ever, and it is our most frequently listened to episode ever. It was an absolute honor to record that episode, and we have some very exciting future episodes coming up with some other Earhart guests that I think a lot of people will be surprised to hear from. So a really big thank you to everybody out there who's listened and downloaded episode 8 with Paul Raffert Jr. It was an absolute pleasure to create it for you. Now, for those who didn't get a chance to listen to that episode, we want to talk a little bit about this week's episode and how this all came about. I reached out to a gentleman named John Hagedorn quite some time ago, and we went ahead and recorded a joint podcast release, and you're about to hear our half of that podcast release. Now, John is the host and the creator of the 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. He actually owns and creates a network of podcasts. The other two are 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. And the third one is 1001 Stories for the Road. The Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries is their chief podcast. And a while back, they did a really good, solid two-part retrospective series on Amelia Earhart, her disappearance, and the many hypotheses regarding the disappearance. And they went in specifically to the Japanese capture hypothesis, which is the hypothesis that they subscribe to and they support. And we thought it was really fascinating the way they did it, and we reached out to John, and he agreed to do a joint podcast release. And the way that's working is we're going to be releasing this particular episode this week, and you can also look for my guest spot on 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. That should be releasing simultaneously with this episode. So it's a really a neat idea that we've kind of come up with, and we're very excited to be doing it. Now, I wanted to also talk about another joint podcast release. We will be working with Astonishing Legends coming up, hopefully in the next month or so. You can be looking out for that, and we'll be, of course, be talking about that on our podcast and on social media and all of that, all those different platforms, and that's going to be a very exciting podcast release and a joint podcast that we're working on with Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess at over there at Astonishing Legends, and we'll be bringing that to you shortly. But for now, let's get to the podcast this week. This is John Hagedorn with 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. John, you're up.
So our guest today is John Hagedorn. He runs a very fascinating podcast called 1001 Heroes and Mysteries and Stories. It's probably, I might have butchered that, but we'll have him cleared up in a minute. John, thank you so much for coming on the Chasing Earhart podcast. It's an honor to have you, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris. Admired the work that you guys are doing, and I was looking forward to this opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And what I want to do, and typically the way I start all my interviews is can you let everybody, for the folks out there who might not follow you or not know of the podcast yet, can you tell us a little bit about your educational, your professional background?
First of all, the podcast is named 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries.
Gotcha.
And, we'll cover it again later, but it's available out there anywhere to anyone who listens to podcasts. My education is Virginia Wesleyan. I have a BA in English and Communications. My hobby for years has been historical research and writing. I've had an active life in terms of things I've done. I've been an entrepreneur, sales and marketing, writing. I've written script for television. I've appeared on television, on Discovery, in both movies and shows like FBI Files. My passion and love is podcasting. I got into it 3 years ago. And I wish it was out there 15 years ago. Absolutely love this medium. and I see a tremendous future for it, and now a participant in it, which is even more exciting.
Yeah, you've got a heck of a show out there. I think it's a great show. A lot of people will hopefully, after they hear this podcast, they'll go out and they'll download some episodes and subscribe to it. So obviously, you know, we're all about Amelia Earhart at the Chasing Earhart Project. That's kind of what my team enticed me to kind of listen to your podcast to check out. Can you tell me a little bit about how Amelia Earhart came into your life and kind of what your earliest recollections of Earhart is?
Yeah, I'd love to. It's a rather strange entry. My wife is a teacher. She's been teaching for years. And a number of years ago, she had a child in her third grade class who was having what you could only describe as some paranormal episodes. And one of those episodes included an outburst on where this little 8-year-old girl felt that Amelia Earhart's bones were. But in the meanwhile, I became fascinated with the legend of Amelia Earhart. And I read Fred Gerner's book. And Fred Gerner's book just unlocked it for me. I thought it was fascinating. And ever since then, whenever a news article appears, I follow it. So I've been a fan of the genre and an ongoing participant in the search for the truth about what happened to her. I find it fascinating. I believe that she and Fred Noonan were heroes, maybe unwilling heroes, but heroes wrapped up in an adventure much larger than themselves, although what they were doing was pretty large for the time. I did two episodes back-to-back here just within the past month, which is how you found us, on Amelia Earhart. I put a lot of research into this, not just recently for the show, but I've been following it all the way along. So I'm pretty sure on my end that I'm connecting the dots in the right way. But the real mystery and thrill of this is that until the U.S. government releases the classified information, which I'm sure they're holding, I think we're going to be still searching for the truth.
So you obviously are a proponent of the Japanese capture hypothesis, which is a very popular one. You mentioned Fred Gerner, who is an Amelia Earhart research pioneer and an icon. And a lot of people have a lot of respect for Mr. Gerner, including myself and the work that he did. Can you talk a little bit about that particular hypothesis in general? I mean, for the folks out there, some of the younger folks who might be following, you know, the project and kind of listening to what we're talking about today, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you believe happened to Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan, on that day, July 2nd, 1937?
The thing about the hypothesis that we're following here is that there were witnesses all along this trail. On July 2nd, 1937, she and Fred Noonan were scheduled to reach a landing point at Howland on the last leg of their journey, Howland Island, out in the Pacific. For one reason or another, it's believed that they ran low on gas, could not locate Howland. And what happened to them after that is really the source for everyone's angst here. I believe that they had conserved their gas on the way out, and I believe they turned. I think their plan was, if they became lost or disoriented, their plan was to turn back until they found a suitable place to land. That's what I believe. And they went a number of miles back in a westerly direction from whence they had come. I believe that they reached Mili Atoll in the Jollywood Islands. And on Bar Reef, I think she crash landed that plane. There have been two small airplane parts discovered there that match a Lockheed Electra 10E. Which I think is very, very important proof, placing a Lockheed Electra 10E on that remote island in the Pacific, and an island that some people don't believe she could have reached, others do believe she could have reached. But there were witnesses that saw Japanese approaching these two, slapping them around a little bit. They heard the woman scream and realized for the first time it was a woman, because the witnesses who saw this saw the short hair and the other man and figured they were both men until they heard Amelia screams. In 1937, it was 4 years before Pearl Harbor, the Japanese were building landing strips throughout the Marshall Islands and the Pacific, territory that they claimed to be theirs. We couldn't fly spy planes over there, but the United States did see the buildup. They knew what was going on. It's very, very believable that they could have asked Earhart and Noonan to mount a camera on that plane, or just to use her camera to photograph as they flew over islands that were currently being made into airstrips. It would have been very important information for United States Naval Intelligence to have.
Right.
Would have put her and Fred Noonan in a dangerous position, but I believe that they agreed to do that. And even if they didn't have photographs, they had flown over it and they had seen it. They knew things that we did not know, probably, and information that our naval intelligence needed. The Japanese were not treating people kindly coming close to those islands. There was a story about that that I'm going to share with you in a second, but they would have been treated as spies in 1937. I believe that they were picked up at Bar Reef, Bele Atoll. They may have been out at that plane for a couple of days trying to communicate with people until the cockpit became flooded. There are people who say that they received ham radio transmissions from her and Fred that said that the plane was now down on a reef, and this lasted for a couple of days. So there were witnesses that saw the plane come down. There were witnesses that saw the Japanese pick them up. Before they went to be interrogated, they were taken aboard the Koshu Maru, which was a Japanese seaplane tender, which was there in the Jollywood area, in Jollywood Harbor.
Right.
There was a doctor brought on board that ship to look at them.
He was one of the many people that Fred Gerner talked to, interviewed, got information from, and others after Gerner. His name was Bilemon Amaron. Among other things, Bilemon said that the men of the crew on board called the woman Amory.
It was a young guy. He was only 20 years old. And he looked at Noonan. Noonan was the one who was bloody. Noonan had suffered some injuries from this accident. Apparently, he had at least surface wounds on his head, possibly forehead from hitting a windshield. And right. He also had a pretty torn up leg. I don't know how that happened. But the doctor said he put a bandage. Noonan had already wrapped a bandage around his head, according to the witnesses. Bilemon said he replaced that with a bandage, and that could have been just a bandage on the forehead. That might, because the forehead will bleed a lot. It doesn't require a big bandage to just patch it. And right. Noonan had fairly long black hair. So it's possible if he put that bandage on his forehead, it wouldn't have been that visible on the outside. But his leg was pretty well torn up, according to this doctor. Earhart apparently physically was okay. So when they got off the Koshu Maru, I believe that they were on the concrete dock at Jollywood, which had just been built about a year previous. I believe that there was a photographer there. He was working for our Naval Intelligence Service, whether he was a part of them or just he was probably just a contractor. He got a picture of that dock. I believe that that picture that surfaced recently very well may have been Earhart and Noonan. The only question being, where was the Japanese guards if they had picked up and they were being guarded? I don't have an answer for that one. But I believe they would have needed to be on that dock to take one of those ferry boats, which is visible in that picture. And this is a picture that shows a dock at Jollywood. It shows the Koshu Maru in the background. It shows what looks to be a barge behind the Koshu Maru carrying a plane that looks, although it's fuzzy and grainy, it does look like the electric. It shows a woman sitting with her back to us on the edge of the dock with short cut hair, very unusual for that time and day. It shows a man, a white man. This was a white woman. It shows a white man standing with a group of men who were apparently islanders. This man, it's also grainy, but his hairline looks very much like Noonan's hairline. And right. At the top of that hairline, where it forms a V with his forehead, you can see one of two things. You're either looking at a bandage or you're looking at a reflection of the sun.
Yeah.
It's white. But if you look at it under a magnifying glass, it looks like it could be a bandage, which would make a lot of sense. So that picture could have well been them. Now, the picture was debunked by all the major networks. They said, no, this comes from a travel book that was dated 1935, 2 years before they would have been on Jollywood. But other people who have dug deeper said that this book was not a professionally published book. And although it gives a published date within the first few pages of 1935, this book is literally strung together and pages could have been added and subtracted. Yeah. And the photograph offered right now at U.S. National Archives, that photo has been declassified. The photo had type showing below it, giving the location and the fact that it was kept by Office of Naval Intelligence. All that typewritten description had been removed for what they say was a Japanese travel book published in 1935. Why it was there, I couldn't tell you. But why would our Office of Naval Intelligence have kept that as classified material until 1977? There's a huge question for you.
Yeah.
So they were taken to the intelligence headquarters at the Miej, which was a seaplane base. They were flown by seaplane from a Miej to Kwajalein, where later they found effects of hers. Again, who did it go to? It ended up going to Naval Intelligence. Then from Kwajalein, I believe they flew her by seaplane to Tanapeg Harbor in Saipan. She was seen landing there. She was under Japanese escort, Japanese guards. She and Fred were then taken to Garapan Jail on the western coast of the island of Saipan, which is 12 miles long. Garapan Jail. Many witnesses saw her there, including people who were in adjacent cells. There were people who, for one reason or another, had business there. She was walked daily for at least some time up to a nearby hotel, which had been converted to a Japanese headquarters in Saipan.
That hotel being the Kabuyashi Ryokan, to which more than one witness said she was relocated, while Noonan, at the same time, was transferred to a military police barracks at Muchot Point.
And she was interrogated there. There were people who saw her sitting out on the balcony as they were hanging laundry outside. There was one woman who stopped and gave her a piece of fruit, which was something she would have greatly appreciated. And in return, this woman said she gave her her ring. Would love to know where that ring is today. There were 22 Marines who told our authors when they went in there later that immediately after we captured Saipan, that the units assigned to the airport there in Saipan as Lido Airfield,
that inside the hangar was an Electra 10E, and one of them even provided the serial numbers on the tail that matched.
These guys, more than one witness, saw that Electra 10E being towed out by a Jeep. They saw gasoline being poured on the 10E after it was test flown and being burned, and witnesses who saw the remnants of that plane being bulldozed into a deep pit, along with parts of other Japanese planes which were captured there at the airfield during the time of our when we invaded Saipan. Then you've got a trail of witnesses, Marine witnesses, who blew a safe in Saipan and found a briefcase in that safe containing a valise, I think it was, containing her effects, notes, Robert papers Wallen. That she had. There were Marines who testified to that. You have locals in Saipan who testified to the killing, beheading of Fred Noonan. A little girl on her way to school along the same path just outside the cemetery in Garapan said she witnessed the beheading of Noonan. And this little girl's report said that two graves were dug, that both Earhart and Noonan were brought out to those graves. Noonan was beheaded. His body was kicked into the grave. Earhart was not. The little girl did not say that Earhart was killed at that time. So the chances are that she survived at least that. It's become a legend on that island. There were so many people who saw two white people in 1937 under Japanese guard in prison there. Many, many, many witnesses. And that's people like Fred Gerner and others who have gone there since. It's no secret to those people. One of the writers, I think it was Mike Campbell, said, yeah, she was hiding in plain sight. I mean, all you have to do is follow all this witness testimony. So I think the witness testimony that these authors and historical researchers have dug up is so convincing, it's very hard to ignore it. You have to put a lot aside if you want to follow other theories.
Right.
And I believe that these people all described these two white people to a T, all these witnesses. And unless they had one big, huge psychic moment together over a period of about 15 years, I really think that that evidence is a little too much to ignore. I do want to share with you another thing that came out of the classified documents that was declassified by the Navy that's now in the United States National Archives. In fact, I'll hold it for a second until you ask some other questions, but it's the story about the bottle.
I think, you know, with everything that you've talked about and all the eyewitness testimony that's out there and, you know, the legend of Earhart in the Marshall Islands and Japanese custody, what I want to do is I want to ask you to speculate a little bit on what you think her morale might have been like. I mean, after this, you know, here's this woman who, you know, was arguably the most famous woman on the planet at the time of her disappearance. And, you know, we can't forget about Fred Noonan. There was a second person on that plane. He was a very brave guy. And he went with her on this journey and they did this together. What do you think? Well, here's it's a two-part question. Do you think the Japanese knew who they had in custody? And at one point, do you think they realized that? And then secondly, what do you think Amelia's morale would have been on that island and, you know, seeing all the things that she's seeing and being treated the way she's being treated and just maybe not seeing an end in sight and seeing that maybe there's only one way this is going to end for her. What do you think that does to someone's morale like that, especially someone who really was, you know, has seemed to have this grasp of fearlessness on life and just, you know, she could kind of confront anything that was put in front of her. How do you think that affected her?
With regard to question one, The Japanese knew exactly who they had. She was a world celebrity. This flight was being followed by the world, not just the United States. There's a newspaper clipping from a Tokyo newspaper that was dated right around July 2nd, 1937, that said she and Fred Noonan had been picked up by a fishing boat. And it said this with a sense of joy that she had survived. I think the people of Japan who were interested in things like this saw them as heroes. She was trying to make the first trip around the world, a second one, I think, in history, first by a female pilot. So she was a heroine to these people. And I think the people of Japan, as witnessed when you read this newspaper caption, were elated that the Japanese had found her and picked her up. But it was squashed. One day it was out there, and the next thing, the papers were pulled. There were no more articles and nothing. So the government had put the kibosh on that news, knowing who they had. But that's interesting. That article had also been picked up and printed in some papers in the United States and probably other countries as well. That yeah. Earhart survived. She was picked up by a fishing boat. News from Tokyo. And that was killed real quickly. With regard to her courage and makeup, she was a very strong person to have accomplished everything that she accomplished and keep your head about her while doing so. She was a strong person to risk a flight like this. She wanted to teach others and to show others, and she wanted to inspire. And she was a huge inspiration to a lot of people. And she carried that mantle so well and so much better than many people have in history. I think she was a great idol for a young man or a young lady to have. In the 30s, those types of people were heroes. They got the real hero treatment, and I think deservedly so, because she inspired so many people to do great things. How tough was she? I believe that her core was as about as strong as anything you could get. I don't think she was a wishy-washy woman. I don't think she was given into fantasies. I think she was pretty very much a realist. I think she knew. If she had been asked to take photographs, we were not at war with Japan in 1937. I think she may have underestimated the threat of what would happen if, for any reason, she and Fred fell into Japanese hands. I think when they did have to crash land at Bar Reef and the Japanese immediately picked her up, I think that she and Fred probably felt they could work this out. All they had to do was show them some visas and identification, and they figured it was just a problem of, hey, you guys don't know who we are. It probably wasn't for maybe a few days until they realized, hey, we're not going to get out of this situation. And I think that's when the toughness and the reality of their situation probably set in. Sadly, there was probably always hope that, you know, how could the United States let something like this happen to them after what they had given after the... Why were they being quiet? Why weren't they sending rescue? Why weren't they negotiating with Japan for their release?
Right.
And I think people still ask today, why? What in the world would have motivated the United States not to come to their aid or assistance?
And well, let's ask that question now. Why not?
I think with the United States, number one, they did not. I don't think the administration at the time was Roosevelt administration. I don't think they wanted to have the world realized that they might have asked Earhart to do a spying mission. And that's exactly what the Japanese would have said. We're holding her because she is a spy. I don't think they wanted to leave themselves open to bargaining. And there was nothing the Japanese needed from us at that time. Anyway, I think with Roosevelt running for re-election, I think he had an opportunity to make a decision within those first few days. I think that intelligence would have found out fairly quickly that they had been picked up. And I think he had an opportunity in those first few days to act or not to act. And once that opportunity was passed, then I think it got harder and harder and harder and harder because they didn't know what her fate was. They didn't know if she'd been, they didn't have a story really other than whatever bits and pieces naval intelligence was able to put together. I don't think they had a story until it was too late. And after that, it's not up to the United States government to report on stories. Either you've got facts or you don't.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, and it's a question I actually haven't yet asked any one of our guests yet. And it has to do with FDR. Obviously, this is a woman who not only, as you've been discussing, was she a world-famous pilot, and you know we've talked about her being possibly one of the most famous women, if not the most famous woman on the planet at the time of her disappearance. But she was also something else. She was also a close personal friend of FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt. They were close. They hung out a lot. She flew, Amelia wanted to teach Eleanor how to fly. I mean, they were close. So this is not only a political thing, but a personal thing for FDR at this point. He finds out she gets captured. She goes missing. The Japanese have her. The Japanese may or may not have communicated that, yes, we do have her. They might have known at the time. We don't know, exactly when they found out or what that case was. But what do you think, how do you think FDR felt about this whole thing personally from a more intimate personal level? Do you think it was difficult for him to not say, look, we need to, I mean, obviously they had the search in the middle of the Great Depression, which was equivalent to about a $6 million search in the middle of the Great Depression for Amelia. But do you think, he had this personal feeling of maybe being responsible that hey, Amelia is now in capture of someone who will be our enemy in a few short years. A lot of people refer to her as the first casualty of World War II, even though it was early on and we hadn't gone to World War II or hadn't participated in World War II. How do you think FDR felt about that personally? How do you think Eleanor felt about that personally? Do you think that weighed on them heavily?
Oh, like an anchor. I think it had to have weighed on their hearts. They knew her personally. Like you said, there was a relationship that they had. It's only a guess, but I would think that Roosevelt asked his military to assess whether or not we could get in there and bring her out of Saipan, whether or not a team of commandos you put the picture together, could have gotten in there and gotten her out of there. And the only thing I can think of, he must have done that. And they must have come back to him and said, it would be suicide. We cannot do it. There's 30,000 Japanese soldiers on Saipan. It's extremely heavily defended. This is the last stop before Japan. They would defend Saipan at all costs. And I'm sure that they had said, you make any efforts to rescue her, we'll kill them both.
Yeah. I find myself wondering if with the United States military that was present on the island at the time, if there was any kind of communication between the U.S. and the outlying forces on the island that maybe, hey, we can possibly get her out, or maybe we can figure out a way to do something. I ask myself that a lot, if that was ever even discussed, if that was ever even on the table.
There was no American presence on Saipan. Guam, yes. Other surrounding islands, yes. But the Japanese attacked Guam the day after Pearl Harbor. I mean, they locked up those islands within 24, 48 hours of Pearl Harbor. They had locked up everything in the Pacific. So we didn't have any American presence. She had long passed at that time. Now, what you mean is American presence, I'm sorry, in 1937. I don't think there was any presence on Saipan in 1937-38. Probably one reason that made a good place to take her and Noonan.
Yeah.
But they did have the military in place there in 1937-38. There were 30,000 Japanese soldiers there, as well as just about 30,000 citizens on Saipan, most of them having come over from Japan.
So, I mean, I know the answer to this question before I ask it, but I want to ask it anyway, just for our listeners. Point blank, did the United, and you alluded to it already, but did the United States government know, in fact, that she was in Japanese custody, and do they still hold that information now? Is that something that's a well-kept secret in the U.S. government that, yeah, we know exactly what happened to Amelia Earhart, but we can't talk about it?
I would say the Japanese have it in their files and the United States have it in their files. There have to have been some kind of agreement that neither one is going to release it, but I can't see that happening. But that seems to be the situation at the time. This is a good time for me to, I'm going to briefly read this letter that was declassified from the Naval Intelligence files. You can find it now in the archives. You're going to find it fascinating. Why it was classified is one of the questions you'll have to run in your mind. Why was this classified? I mean, I think it's going to help to connect a few dots about what U.S. Naval Intelligence knew. This is a typewritten letter that came from France, dated 7th of January, 1939. It's the report of Amelia Earhart as prisoner in the Marshall Islands. Mr. Hepinot, the chief of the Far Eastern section of the French Foreign Office, allowed the writer to read some papers found in a bottle washed ashore near Bordeaux. This communication will in time be delivered to the American embassy here. The entire story follows. On 30th of October, a Mrs. Barrett, age 37, while walking on the beach near Sault-sur-Mer,
on the Atlantic coast just south of the mouth of the Girard River found a bottle of about a half pint size, stoppered with a cork, over which wax had been poured. Found in the bottle were a lock of chestnut-colored hair, a paper with the words in French, "God guide this bottle. I confide my life and that of my companions to it," and a third paper, all of which were delivered to the gendarmes who eventually sent them on to Paris. The third paper mentioned above contained, on one side written in French, the following: "I have been a prisoner at Jaluit, in the Marshalls, by the Japanese, in the prison there. I have seen Amelia Earhart," and it says in parentheses, "aviatrix, and in another cell, her mechanic, a man, as well as several other European prisoners, held on charge of alleged spying on large fortifications erected on the atoll. Earhart and companion were picked up by Japanese hydroplane and will serve as hostages, any Japanese. I was imprisoned because I disembarked on Mille Atoll. My yacht, Vevro, V-E-V-R-O, sunk. My crew, 3 Macris sailors, killed. My yacht, 26-ton sailing ship, was equipped with radio." On the other side of this paper, the story continues. "After having been kept long time in Jaluit, I was forcibly enrolled as a stokehold head on board Nippon Nori, bound for Europe. We'll try to escape when ship gets near to port. Carry this message to gendarmes immediately so that we can be freed. This message is to be thrown overboard probably near Santander and should arrive in Brittany toward September or at latest October 1938. This is message number 6. To have a good chance of freeing Miss Earhart and her companion and also other prisoners, police should arrive incognito at Jaluit. I will be with," next word is undecipherable, "and if I succeed in escaping, because if Japanese are asked to liberate the prisoners, they will say that none are detained at Jaluit. One must be tricky. The hair is Miss Earhart's and will prove the veracity of this story and that I have seen Amelia Earhart supposedly dead. This bottle will serve as a float for a second bottle containing some objects of Miss Earhart. I'm writing on my knees because I have only a little paper, some left over when Japanese police took fingerprints. The second bottle referred to has not been found, but the bottle found had on the bottom the following stamped inscription, VB2. And that's 908 Intelligence. Confidential's been scratched through, and the release for March 1, 1977 to release this from confidential files was given.
So let's talk about this. I have a lot of questions. So the first question is obviously, who is this person who wrote this?
The owner of the yacht Vevro.
Do we have a name or anything like that?
Nope. Although so, that should be on record somewhere in France.
Okay. So that starts, that gives us something to kind of go on. Earhart's hair. How did he get a hold of Earhart's hair? How did that work out?
He was also in prison there. So I don't think it would have been impossible to take a lock of hair.
In another cell, though, I'm assuming, right? So he would have been in prison in another cell, not Earhart's.
In another cell. Well, we don't know. But probably, yeah.
That is fascinating. And I think it reads like a movie. It really does. It's an interesting piece of evidence. So
let's assume for a moment that it's a in 1938, just months after her disappearance, that some crank decides, I'm going to create a story. Now, it just so happens that of all the places in the world for him to create a story, he picks Jaluit.
Right.
And then he describes the fact that the Japanese picked him up because he sailed a little too close. In fact, he tried to make a landing there. So they're protecting it. They don't want anybody in there. They don't want anybody talking about their buildup there. And it just so happens that he's going with the whole theory that both Noonan and Earhart survived the crash. I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
Unless he's psychic. And the fact that it's Jaluit, where we later on, years later, found witnesses to say, yes, they saw a silver plane circling. They saw a silver plane crash landing on the reef. That they saw the Japanese take these two into custody. Now, here's the big question. Why was this kept confidential? If it's just a crank letter that some psychic put together in 1938.
Agreed.
It's just too much.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It was beautifully written too. I'm listening, I'm, you know, kind of hanging on each word as you read it, and it's very interesting piece of evidence. And I'm wondering if, you know, we'd spoken to Les Kinney and Dick Spink and a lot of the folks that were involved in the Lost Evidence documentary that recently came out, and they had mentioned that, you know, that there was supposed to be a much larger documentary. It was supposed to be, you know, 4-hour documentary. Instead, it ended up being 2. I'm wondering if that was one of the pieces of information that they had to leave out of the documentary because of time constraints or whatever.
I did not see the documentary, so that was not included then, I assume.
No, it wasn't, but it might have just been because of time constraint, because they couldn't maybe they couldn't fit everything into the time that they had. But yeah, I'd love to read that letter. I think we'll have our team put it up on the website,
and that'd be great,
so they can check it out and read it for themselves. So what I want to do is, you know, I want to get to where we can wrap up a little bit here, but I want to ask you a couple of questions about impact and legacy, because I think that's really important. Obviously, 2017 is the 80th anniversary of Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan's disappearance. She seems to be hotter than she ever has been right now with the Lost Evidence documentary and everything that's kind of come to light and come to the surface in the last several months. What I want to know from you, just, and it's a personal speculation, is why do you think, and people go missing all the time, obviously, she was, you know, someone very important and very impactful for the time, but why do you think 80 years later that the world is still continued to be fascinated with Amelia Earhart and her disappearance? What is it about Earhart in general that just, this story does not go away, and I don't think it'll ever go away until it's solved definitively?
In the world we live in today, there are very few mysteries. We're able to get to the bottom through advances in DNA, through advances in archaeology, through advances in sonar technology, you name it. A lot of things that have been mysteries for years have been discovered and opened up, and the mysteries put to rest. I think in this case, that a lot has been purposely buried till somebody's ready to open some of those locked doors that we'll never know. We're just going to have to reason and put the dots together ourselves. And I think because it is one of the biggest mysteries still remaining out there, I think it's just gained in popularity. People do love mysteries. And in the case of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, they were world celebrities. So it's not a local mystery. It's not just one country's mystery. It's a mystery that a lot of people would love to solve.
Right.
I think for some of these researchers, and certainly what motivates me is the fact that these two volunteered to do this. They're not spies. They weren't military people. They weren't working for the government. These two were totally committed to aviation, teaching others, inspiring others. And so they were innocents that were caught up in a much larger web, not of their own doing. And I think I think the truth deserves to be told. I think that they're both heroes. And I think that we owe it to them to continue the search and to keep digging and to find the truth. Just from my little viewpoint here, I'm going to let as many people know about her story as I can. And that's why I did the podcast for 1001
Right.
Heroes.
Right.
So I hope I can help in some small way from what I'm doing. And I certainly respect and appreciate all of the researchers and authors and people and your organization and Tiger and all the rest, regardless of where their theories are taking them, they're trying very hard to uncover the truth. And I think that search for the truth is terrific.
I would agree with you. Thank you. Okay. Well, I know you talked about the podcast a little earlier, but where can people follow you online in addition to the podcast itself? Where can they find you?
Our home website is at www.1001storiespodcast.com. And that's the house for 3 podcasts that we do. 2 are active right now. One is 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. And the other one is 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. So that's our home site. But anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can go to Google and search 1001 Heroes Podcast, and you'll find 37,000 trails all leading you to us. We're definitely at Apple, iTunes. Subscribing is free. If you're not familiar with podcasts, podcasts are free. You subscribe to places. If you have an Apple iPhone, an iPad, smartphone, you download the Apple Podcast app, and it's free to do. And that stores the shows that you like for you and notifies you when the new shows come out. And most of us are weekly shows like mine. Mine comes out every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, and it'll hit Apple by about 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Sunday nights. If you're Android, you've got 1,000 choices. You can go to Stitcher.com. That's a podcast catcher. Podbay.fm, one of my favorites. Very easy to use. It's got reviews on there, the whole deal. Podbay.fm. Love that one. It's a great podcatcher and one that I highly recommend. My host is audioboom.com, and that's where that home website that I just listed has. So you can subscribe to audioboom.com. We're a sponsored show. We appreciate our sponsors very much. They're our life's blood, and they've made this a lot more than a hobby for me, something I very much enjoy, but I also am able to keep the lights on thanks to our sponsors. But it's our fans I'm most appreciative of. 1001 Heroes fans are absolutely fantastic. And I know they're going to look forward to this segment that you're doing now. And we're going to make sure we're telling them all about you and sending them to all of your work. And hopefully you'll be able to update us as you discover new things along the way. We would appreciate it very much.
Yes, thank you very much. Folks, get out there and subscribe to this podcast. It's an awesome podcast. John's a great guy. They do a lot of great work there. 1001 Heroes. Just Google it. Like you said, there's many different ways to find them. John, it's been an absolute pleasure. What can I say? Thank you for coming aboard the Chasing Earhart podcast, and we'll be talking soon.
Thank you, Chris. We're looking forward to it, and we're right there with you in terms of anything new that turns up. We'll share both ways. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was John Hagedorn. He is the host of 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. It's a great podcast. We highly recommend that you check it out. They have a lot of great stuff, not just on Earhart, but just in general. It's a very fascinating podcast, and a lot of people really seem to enjoy it. So Google search that, or you can search it on iTunes, Google Play, or any other podcast platform on the market today. It's a very great show, and we're very honored to be a part of it. Be on the lookout for the simultaneous interview that I did with John, and that's going to be released, I believe, on the same day as this one. So if you search that particular podcast, you should get the episode with me as a guest on his show. And it was a lot of fun to do it. Very humbled and honored to be part of a production like that. And we really hope you enjoy what we brought to you there. Now, I want to touch on our YouTube channel that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. We are launching a YouTube channel for Chasing Earhart. As a matter of fact, we did officially launch it with our teaser trailer that we dropped about 10 days ago now. And that particular YouTube channel will be hosting all of our spotlight videos. Eventually, we'll have over 130 of those on that channel. It'll also host presentations from folks like Ann Pellegrino and Gary LaPook and quite a few others that we're going to be having in the near future that we'll be announcing and discussing. And the YouTube channel will also host our trailer, of course, and then our subsequent theatrical release trailer that we're going to put out. So we have a lot of content for the YouTube channel. We should be launching that officially with the spotlight video part of it in the next week or two. You can, of course, search Chasing Earhart on YouTube, and you'll see the trailer will come up, and that's the only thing we've got right now. But we are actually readying some content as we speak, and the team is really getting ready to drop some really great stuff. So we hope you enjoy it. It's the first piece of interview footage from Chasing Earhart that you'll see. We're very excited to debut that for everybody, and we really hope you check it out. Now, before I get out of here for this week, I want to talk about next week's guest. Next week's guest is Robert Wheeler. He is the co-author of Amelia Earhart Betrayed, which is a very fascinating book that was released in July of 2012. It's gotten a lot of great press in the news. It's gotten a lot of information out there, and it's gotten a lot of feedback out there. It's a great episode, a great interview that we did. We really get into the Japanese capture hypothesis with Robert. There's been some changes since the book has come out a few years ago, so we want to kind of go over those changes with him and how things have shifted in his research and his knowledge since the book is released. So it makes for an exciting kind of an update to the book that was released about 5 years ago. And we're very happy to have Robert on. That will be next week. So until then, this is Chris Williamson. Thank you for joining us on Chasing Earhart for episode 9. We will see you in a week with Robert Wheeler in episode 10.